broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University. This is WSDL Ocean City, 90.7 FM, Delmarva Public Radio. It's time now for a special writer's edition of Delmarva Today with host Harold Wilson.
What is the magic in good literature, and why does it move us so deeply? Welcome to Delmarva Today, the writer's edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. Today, we're going to talk about the wonderful magic in the poetry, stories, and essays in the sixth edition of the Delmarva Review that will be coming out on October 1. Executive editor of the Review, Wilson Wyatt, is in our studio today, along with fiction writer Margaret Adams and poet William Peake. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
Yep, thank you for having us.
A pleasure to be here, Hal.
In the interest of full disclosure, let me say that I am one of the co-fiction editors of the Delmarva Review. And so, of course, I have a thoroughly biased perspective here. I find this coming issue chock full of wonderful writing. Wilson, the next edition will be the sixth issue of the Delmarva Review. Tell us a little bit about this issue.
It'll be hard to stop, Hal, so you'll have to put the brakes on, but this, we feel, is a very strong issue. Every year we like to think it's our best. It's our sixth issue. We have it's the largest issue in our history. It's 128 pages of content, which is significant for us. And we've heard from hundreds of writers' submissions for this issue. It's good to know that writing continues to prove the value of providing a good home for imaginative, compelling work at the Delmarva Review. In this issue, we have 23 authors. Some are professionals, and some are brand new voices, which is always good to hear. 65% of the writers come from the Delmarva Peninsula, or the immediate environment. The rest are from nine states and the District of Columbia. So we've got quite a number of fans around the country. I should mention that the Review is a nonprofit review, and it is published by the Eastern Shore Writers Association. The proofreaders, the copy editors, the editors like you and me are all experienced and dedicated volunteers. I hope that answers your question about this issue.
Well, it comes close to answering my question, Wilson. Let me ask you, this to me is a special issue, and I want to know, what do you feel is special about this issue? For example, I do know that you solicited at least one submission for this issue. Would you tell us about that process and about that solicitation that you did?
Happy to, and we're delighted with the results. I contacted Ron Capps, who's the founder of the Veterans Writing Project, and he agreed to write a personal essay for us, which is published in this issue. So he became our featured writer for that reason. It's an outstanding piece, really quite an example, an excellent example of personal essay, which is a hard thing to write well. So we're thrilled with that. We also have a large number of poems in this issue. Ann Caldwell, the poetry editor, selected 31 poems from 11 poets, Bill being one who's with us, and quite a diversity of poetry, some very accessible, some very difficult.
Mine's one of the accessible ones.
Yours is accessible, yeah. Yes.
Oh.
And we're thrilled to have you as our as a poetry writer for us. So you've also written before for us, so we're pleased. In the fiction In the fiction category, we're delighted to have seven pieces of short fiction, one flash fiction piece, actually, which is quite good about personal identity. And one of the authors who's with us today, Margaret Adams, her piece called Undertow, I will never think of blueberry pie the same way ever again. Exactly. And I'll let the readers decide what that means.
Right. Well, Wilson, clearly the review's been a very successful venture over the years, with this being the sixth book that that you've put out. I understand you were involved in the creation of the and the establishment of the Delmarva Review. Would you tell us how that came about and who was involved in the creation of the review with you?
I'd be happy to. It started out because the Eastern Shore Writers Association had a publication for members only, and it would publish members' work. After a while, the work became the submissions became almost non-existent, and part of that is there just weren't that many writers around at the time. But the other reason is because writers like good company when they publish something, and several of us got together and created the Delmarva Review as a legitimate literary review to stand on its own two feet against all other literary reviews, of which there are 3,000 in the country. There's quite a lot of competition. But the point is here, it was very interesting. We put it out to the membership of the Eastern Shore Writers. We asked over 200 writers across the Delmarva Peninsula what they thought of the idea. Over 80% wanted to do it, which is fascinating. Because it takes a little bit of courage to put your writing up against the writing of other people, wherever they come from around the world. And that's exactly what happened. The first time we put notice that we were accepting submissions on the internet, the first submission came in from Denmark. And we all thought to ourselves, uh-oh, what is it we've gotten ourselves into?
Well, that's impressive.
But since then, we've published over 130 different authors from around the country and seven foreign countries. Again, about two-thirds of them coming from the Delmarva area.
Well, again, you certainly felt that there was a need for a literary publication in this area. What, even in general, what need do you feel that literary publications of this type fill?
Literary writing is the far end of the literary spectrum, if you will, and literary reviews fill that niche. It's sort of like this is the end of the rainbow for some. This is the place I want to aspire to. I want to write well enough that I can be published in a literary review. You know automatically that your writing has to be good in order to be considered in a literary review, so you work your best. So what is the purpose behind the Delmarva Review? At least one of the purposes was to create something that writers would aspire to encourage them to write their best and to compete. And it's still a great avenue for writers around the Delmarva Peninsula. You still have a better chance there than, let's say, the Paris Review, for example. But it's... But all kidding aside, I mean, it has really created opportunities for, again, about 130 different authors, and that's terrific.
Well, that's excellent, and I can certainly vouch for the value of the Delmarva Review as a literary publication. And as a literary publication, Margaret, you've contributed a short story to this
yes.
issue, Undertow. And this will make the third contribution the Delmarva Review has published of your work.
Yeah.
I think your essay, Nursing 101, which I frankly remember very well, was published in 2011, and you were nominated for the Pushcart Prize.
Yes.
for that essay. And I believe you were in nursing school at the time, so
yes,
you wrote from direct experience. And now you are working as a registered nurse in Baltimore. Undertow, however, is not Baltimore. Undertow is set in Maine. Tell us a little bit about Undertow and a little bit about its Maine setting and your connection to Maine.
Okay. So Undertow is set on the coastal areas of Maine in a kind of insular boat working community. And it's a little bit about that community, really. I would say it's more than just set there.
I know something about the coast of Maine, and I just have to ask you directly. Are we talking about Camden, Maine here, or that area of Maine at all where the windjammers go in and out of?
Well, so I will say I grew up outside of Bangor, and I did work on the windjammers out of Rockland and Camden in that area. And so the story is not deliberately set in any of those towns. It's not that I had a template in mind for one of those towns or one of those harbors when I wrote the story, but it is definitely based on my experiences working there and being immersed in that community.
What kind of work did you do on the windjammers? That's very interesting.
So I was a galley cook for a season.
Mm-hmm. You were the Kate in your story,
yes,
right?
Yes, I would have been the Kate.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And before that, actually, as a high schooler, I finished my high school education through an alternative education program on board a schooner. So that also had a lot of influence on my familiarity with boat working culture. But I certainly took liberties as well. And I am, to a certain extent, also an outsider because I'm from inland Maine. So, but it was it's a part of Maine that has always captured my imagination growing up as being kind of a world within a world and also a ticket to many other worlds as boats.
Absolutely. It's a gorgeous area of our country and a very old and a very unique part of our country, I would suggest as well. The name of your story is Undertow.
Yes.
But for me, the story moves with the ebb and flow of the tide. You even talk about the rhythm of the port and the town. But you say it's comfortably different from human action.
Yeah.
Then again, you say you can feel the pulse. Well, I can feel in your story the sense of the ebb and flow of human actions as well. Tell us a little bit about Undertow, and then I'm going to ask you to read a selection from your story.
So there's a little bit of a duality there. This is a community of boat workers where the tides, the weather, they all are separate from human actions in that, you know, humans can't affect them, but very intertwined in that the weather and the tides dominate so many aspects of their lives and really influence them, and so you're kind of forced to adapt and work around them constantly. And the protagonist is a young woman who is kind of figuring out how to communicate in many ways, and she's kind of looking at these forces both literally as something that permeate her entire world and metaphorically. And I think she's feeling kind of helpless with regards to some of the patterns that are kind of the forces in her life, like the tides, like the weather, and also patterns that she has personally been falling into. And that helplessness is reassuring in some ways, in that, you know, if you can't control it, there's nothing you could have done differently, so there's not as much room for regret. And I think that's true for many aspects of life when you're dependent on the weather and the tides for boat workers, but also a little defeating.
Well, let me ask you to read a short passage from Undertow that talks about the rhythms of the town.
Certainly. Okay. This town, like all ports, has its own rhythm, one that is comfortingly separate from human actions. Even standing here in the door of the bakery, I can feel it, the underlying pulse. Breathe in deeply, and there it is, under the yeasty scent of dough, the salty, rusty smell of seawater. The tides come in, go out again, the seasons change, and the wood planks shift inevitably as they expand and contract. Live here long enough, and you'll feel those tides beating in your veins. People react to it in a few different ways. Some are solid, unflinching as granite, taking what comes with the indifference of fish bound in the currents. Others find themselves shifting constantly in the face of it, erratic and capricious, as predictably unpredictable as April storms. And in the end, however many boats they wreck, even April storms will not alter the pulse of tides nor the steady pull of undertow.
Margaret, what is undertow in your story?
So undertow just literally is, it's a subsurface ocean current that is going back out to sea after waves break on shore. So you see the wave breaking on shore, and then below the surface of the water where you can't see, there is this pull back out to sea that happens consistently. And depending on what kind of a beach you're on, the undertow can be quite a strong force. In the story, I just felt that the image of undertow was very evocative of some of the challenges that the protagonist is facing in the story. And she has this kind of metaphorical undertow that's going through her emotional landscape where she is just getting sucked back into some patterns again and again. And she's kind of taking a step back and looking at it. And I think over the course of the story, she is trying to figure out how much control over that she does have.
Well, it's beautifully, it's just beautifully written.
Thank you.
There's also a sense of the ebb and flow in Lauren's life. Mm-hmm. As you mentioned, she's pulled in, but at the same time, there's a return.
Yeah.
And I think that's beautifully stated in your story. So in Lauren's own life, particularly her relationship with Darren, there is this ebb and flow and this pull. Would you read that? A short section on her relationship
It was Darren who told me to keep tough talking, but to be able to scrap if I had to. I can take care of myself, I said, and he smiled at me in a way that I couldn't read yet. And there, last night in the pub, was my poorly curled fist flying at him, clumsy with emotion, unsure, throwing us all off balance. Darren was almost a decade older than me, and looked it. Only once or twice, though, in the inscrutable way that he glanced at me through the smoke from the cigarettes he rolled himself to save money, could I feel the age difference. He'd be gone for a month, maybe two, and then there he'd be, back at the boathouse, waiting for me. We'd smile at each other, hands guarded in our pockets, searching for a welcome. Then we'd fall into step as he joined me wherever I was going. We never named our relationship as though even that act of recognition would change it.
Margaret, I'm torn because I wish I had time to ask you about the naming of a relationship and what the naming of a relationship means. If you can give me a very short answer to that, what would you say?
Oh, well, you know, I think that's one of Lauren's big conundrums over the course of this story. And I think that comes back to, in parts, the ways that the physical rhythms of the world that they're living in are reflecting the people and how the people are kind of turning back to reflect it. And I think for her to name something is to try to kind of isolate it and pin it down in a place where everything is in flux and where she herself is in flux and figuring out who she is. So it's
beautifully
complex.
Beautifully stated. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. This will be the sixth piece, as I said, that you published, the third piece that you published. And truly, I believe you are an exceptional writer.
Thank you
for this story. Bill, you've been published previously in the Delmarva Review as well, a short story entitled What We See. And that was in the 2009 issue. And in the upcoming issue, you're going to have two excellent poems, Melissa and Flight 486. Well, you're in very good company here, I believe. As Wilson said, I've read all the poetry in this issue, and it is exceptional. I'll admit that some of it is not readily accessible, but if one works with it and gives it a chance, it does yield great rewards for the reader. Margaret's a nurse these days working in Baltimore. Bill, what do you do when you're not writing short stories and poetry?
I cut a lot of grass, and I also, my wife makes me do that, but I work for the Talbot County Free Library. And going back to something Wilson was talking about earlier with you about the importance of the Delmarva Review, I think I can speak to that as a library guy. In Talbot County, people say that one out of every five Talbot Countyans is a painter. And that's probably about true. There are a lot of painters in Talbot County. But of the remainder, I would say close to half are writers or trying to be writers. I see them come into the library all the time, doing their research, finding the study rooms to have quiet time to work on and draft and redraft what they're writing. There are a lot of us out there, and everybody, I think, to one degree or another, has a desire to express themselves. And that's another reason I think the Delmarva Review is so important to a place like this, to give people the opportunity to do that.
Thanks, Bill. Your poem, Melissa, expresses a beautiful image, I believe. Would you read it for us?
Sure. Melissa. Her hand with age has narrowed like a swimmer's at the top of her stroke, the thumb rotating slowly toward the palm, the little finger beginning a similar circuit so that someday, perhaps, the two shall meet where I would kiss and still would kiss each change, if it were permitted, acknowledged, that this is a hand approaching the end of its stroke.
How did you come to this image, Bill, of a swimmer's hand changing?
To be quite honest, I was lying in bed next to my beautiful wife, and she was asleep, and I was looking at her hands and marveling over them, and noticing that with age, her hand has sort of begun to curl a little bit, and some people's do. And I am a swimmer, too. I go to the Y two or three times a week and swim. And so I was automatically saw the connection, the relationship to the way a swimmer's hand turns at the top of a stroke. And so I began to live with that. And when I swim, I always tell myself I don't swim through water, I swim through my thoughts. And yeah. I found this poem sort of developing in my mind as I'd swim along. And it probably took a couple of months before I finally put something down on paper, and this is where I ended up.
So what does the changing hand mean in this poem for you?
Change is kind of what the poem's all about, in a sense, to change over time. But it's also, in a sense, I think, about constancy, because, despite the changes, despite the fact that we're 37 years older than we were when we first met, I still find her just as amazing and remarkable as she was when I first met her. And that's remarkable to me, because I didn't really think that I would ever be capable of that sort of affection. I was a jerk as a young guy, and that she could inspire that kind of devotion. She's a remarkable lady, and she deserves poems.
Well, she certainly inspired a beautiful poem, and it strikes all of us, because all of us, to some degree, are swimming through time, through space, to an inevitable curling of the hand, as it were. Your second poem is Flight 486. Would you read that one for us?
Flight 486. Oh, wait. Flight 486. Flying through the night all alone with the knowledge that my father is dying, that even now, somewhere beneath me, Dad lies in his own night. Dim light, muted voices, while far above him, unseen, his son flies to him, flies to see him, unseen, one last time.
Tell us about this poem, Bill.
One more verse. Down the darkened fuselage, my fellow passengers study their books, look at their watches, nod off beneath the cabin lights. Sorry.
Now tell us about this poem.
The... Well, it's sort of did have an interesting genesis in that, I flew home. My dad had a massive stroke, and I flew home to be with him at the end, and then to help my mom with the funeral and all. And afterwards, about 2 months later, I was emptying out a piece of carry-on luggage that I hadn't gotten all the pockets cleaned out of, and I found the airline ticket jacket, and I'd written the beginnings of this poem on that ticket jacket. And I remembered doing it, but I'd forgotten in the intervening time. And so I sat and took some time with it and began to work over it. This one took quite a while, and I ended up with this poem.
It's beautiful. Death is so personal when it's one of our own. The feeling of dislocation comes when we recognize the total indifference of the rest of the world to our concern and our problem and our loss. At the same time, the poem connects us with people everywhere because everyone has experienced this this sense of loss. And of course, I would say that the magic in great literature is exactly the connection that you have made us, that you have made us feel. And it's interesting because on the one hand, the poem isolates us, and on the other hand, it connects us with everyone. And it's beautiful in that respect. Wilson. Ron Capps deals with the concept of terrible loss as well in his essay, Writing My Way Home. It is both mental loss and physical loss. Would you read a short section of Ron Capps' essay in which he talks about writing himself out of this loss?
Yes, the beauty of his piece is that it does two things. It strikes a chord with your emotions, and at the same time, it gives you information. And I'm going to read the short piece about information. The healing part works like this. When someone, anyone, goes through a traumatic event, whether it's combat or a car crash or a violent physical assault, the brain goes into a flight or fight mode. It tells the body to release huge amounts of cortisol and adrenaline. Big brain functions get pushed aside, and the tiny little lizard brain, the amygdala, takes over. If you survive the event, the big brain stuff goes back and you move on. It's when you try to remember this stuff that things get really messy. When you access a memory, the brain tries to recreate the exact sequence of events, to recreate the exact precise memory. It drags stuff out of a visual cortex and the auditory cortex. It tries to push the same synapse to fire the same sequence so you could get an accurate memory. This is fine if you're remembering a nice cinnamon roll or playing catch with your dad. But if you're remembering a violent attack, not so much. Your brain will try to recreate the same sequence of events, including pushing cortisol and adrenaline, the breathing, the heart rate, the sights, and the sounds. You will basically relive the event. These flashbacks and intrusive images, for many of us, are an inherent part of PTSD. Writing helps, as would music or art or dance, any of the creative arts, by placing a learning skill into the mix. Writing requires using stuff lodged in the big part of your brain. Your body can't simply create the same sequence of synapse firings and bodily reactions. By adding writing to the mix, you've just draped a wet blanket over a hot fire, or used gloves to pick up a hot pan. Choose your metaphor. You forced your big brain to play, and that reduces the stress of remembering a little bit at a time.
Thank you, Wilson. Well, the taste you've given us today indicates that the upcoming issue of the Delmarva Review will be a great treat for everyone. Wilson Wyatt, Margaret Adams, Bill Peek, thank you for joining us today on Delmarva Today, the writer's edition. All right, everyone. Enjoy the magic in the sixth edition of the Delmarva Review. Then get to work on your own submissions for issue number 7 coming up next year. This is your host, Harold Wilson. Thank you for listening to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition.